John, I want to start the interview off. Just so you know, I was 4 years old when you ran against Carter and Reagan.
Now you're giving your age away.
Yeah, and most of our listeners are probably actually younger than me, probably weren't even born when this went on. I was wondering if you could, just because of the similarities between some of the things that happened to you and the things that are happening now with Nader that people my age are really getting excited about, could you go into a little bit of the history of that, specifically how the League of Women Voters sued to get you into the debates and how you were excluded the second time?
Yeah. They, as you have just indicated, were the sponsor, and they invited me on the basis of polls that showed that I was above 15%. In the spring of the year, it actually they had hovered between 25 and 28%. And then they went about soliciting the president, namely Jimmy Carter, and he refused on the grounds that he would be debating two Republicans, even though by that time in the campaign, we're talking now of the first debate occurring at the end of September, and the negotiations were all conducted after Labor Day. And many months had gone by since my April 24th declaration that I was an independent, running quite on my own and without the backing of the Republican Party, who had nominated, of course, Ronald Reagan. And the issues were clear between the two of us, between Reagan and I. I condemned his economic policies, his tax and spend, tax that is, tax reduction program, and then spending for the military. I condemned his lack of an energy policy and made bold to even recommend a 50-cent-a-gallon tax to induce conservation. And he was not willing to propose anything of that kind. So there was a wide gulf, and Carter was not quite true to the promise he made in the primary, that he was a man who would never lie to you. When he said that, he was telling a big fat fib. But nevertheless, the league persevered and went ahead with the debate without him. But then as the election drew near, they were desperate to retain the authority of their role as the lead sponsor of the debates and felt that without getting the president involved that might be challenged. So they finally listened to his blandishments that he would appear, but only if I were not on the platform. And they went ahead in Cleveland with the debate, the climactic debate, which was a week before the election. And the election was framed in terms of two candidates only for the 100 million people, probably almost that many, that watched, much more than have watched, incidentally, any of the three debates with Bush and Gore. The audience, as you probably know, has declined appreciably from that time 20 years ago. So that, in brief, is the chronology of why I was in one debate. Reagan, of course, had agreed all along to have me on the platform, thinking, I suppose, that I would take votes from Carter, although the final analysis post-election showed that I had taken as many votes from him as I had from Carter. They both lost ground because of my independent candidacy. Does that about sum it up?
That's great. Now, speaking in terms of, I guess, pure speculation, had you been in the second debates, do you feel you would have possibly won? Or
I have not made the claim that I would have won, but I have made the claim that I would have at least doubled the final percentage, which was just under 7%. I think I would have had between 15 and 20%. I might have even done as well. Well, I would have done as well as Perot because he got 18.9. I would have equaled that, and I would have done it 12 years earlier, and I would have given tremendous impetus to the third-party movement, which I didn't feel really existed with the margin that I did receive.
Okay, this actually brings up another question of mine, and it revolves around the Center for Voting and Democracy research into, instant runoff voting and the occasions when a president will receive less than 50% of the vote and get in. This happened in, of course, 92 with Perot.
10 out of 22 of the last elections, if you go back, that phenomenon has occurred, that we do not have an elected president who enjoys a majority vote of confidence from the voting public. As you've just indicated, Clinton had 43% in 92 and 49 and a fraction in 96, but not a majority. And I think that's unfortunate. It's a situation that could be remedied by instant runoff voting because if you added the second choice votes, that could be accomplished by computers very quickly. You could declare a winner on the basis of more than 50% of the public choosing him either as their first or second choice, which I think would enable him to govern with more authority than he can if he comes in as a plurality winner, but not a majority winner.
Now, we're actually looking at a possibility that I saw mentioned on one of my station's commercial competitors, that the possibility that the president may enjoy the electoral victory without the popular victory.
Yeah, that happened in 88, and it happened in 76, and it happened, actually, I guess, in 24. So 1824, that is. So sure, I think that in the end it will not occur, but the possibility is real, and it points up, I think, the total inadequacy, indeed the historical anachronistically inept provision that still lingers in the Constitution. We got rid of having state legislatures elect senators. We made that a little bit more democratic by subjecting them to popular election. Why in heaven's name don't we follow suit and say the president ought to be popularly elected by the people? Why should we even run the risk, as has been suggested, that Gore or Bush, either one, might end up with a majority of the popular vote and be denied the presidency because they were distributed, those votes that they got that were popular votes were distributed in a way that brought one or the other a majority of the electoral vote without getting a majority of the popular vote overall. And why should we run that risk? Because I think it would diminish the credibility of a president tremendously to hold office for 4 years on that basis.
And John, for a near layman like myself, what is the difference between instant runoff voting and proportional representation?
Well, proportional representation cannot be applied to a unitary office like that of president because you can't apportion the vote very well. There's only one person in the race, or one person, I should say, to be elected. There are more people in the race, but only one to be elected. In contrast, if you have a multi-member institution like a state legislature, like the Congress of the United States, there you could use proportional representation, but unfortunately, under a 67 law that was passed largely in order to protect the 65 Voting Rights Act, Congress froze into law a provision that you could only have single-member districts, 435 members of Congress, 435 congressional districts. It had not always been so. No such provision had existed for the first more than 50 years of the Republic. The law, I think, for single districts was first passed in 1842. Then, for some reason, it was allowed to lapse. It lapsed in the early 20th century, and it wasn't placed in the law again until 1967, largely to prevent southern states from running all members of Congress at large in order to submerge the African-American minority and deny them seats. Congress put in this provision that you had to elect each member from a particular district. Unfortunately, we are now faced with the problem that that has not provided adequate minority representation either, because we've had a series of cases starting in 1993 in the U.S. Supreme Court. The first very celebrated case was out of the state of North Carolina. And the court, in several decisions, has laid down the principle that if districts are created fundamentally along racial lines, and if that's the fundamental reason for the reapportionment map, which draws the actual lines for the districts, those districts can be struck down as a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. To get around that, what we need to do is to repeal the single-member district requirement now on the federal statute book. It wouldn't take a constitutional amendment, just a repeal of that law. And then the reapportionment authority, be it the state legislature, be it the courts, if the legislature can't agree, could draw multi-member districts. They could draw districts with three or four members And then you could simply, using the principle of apportionment, elect somebody in a three-member district. Actually, it works out if you've got 25.6% of the vote. You would be sure to have one of the three members in a three-member district. It would solve the problem of adequately representing racial minorities. At least it would alleviate it greatly. And it would also, I think, make the elected body, be it the state legislature or the Congress, more responsive to the electorate, in that now we proceed on the badly flawed assumption that if somebody gets a plurality in a single-member district, say he only gets 40% of the vote, he's the winner, even though 60% of the people may have voted for two other candidates. One maybe got 25, one got 35. He was first past the post with 40%, so he wins. In fact, not all of those 60% people are 60% of the people who voted for someone who lost are going to feel adequately represented. They would feel much better if they could elect one of three in a three-member district. So that's proportional representation used by most democracies in the world. We inherited this single-member first-past-the-post system from the British. Other than the British, the Canadians, ourselves, India, Pakistan, and a few Caribbean countries, most every democracy in the world elects its legislature along the lines that I have just outlined by proportional representation. They're more democratic. They're more representative. They elicit a much better turnout. Women are more often elected than they are now. We have only 11% of the women in the House. 11% of the membership are women. In Scandinavian countries that use proportional representation, or PR, as we fondly refer to it, Scandinavian countries commonly elect between 30, even over 40% of the membership composed of women, which more nearly obviously comports with their percentage of the population. So from the standpoint of minorities, from the standpoint of people generally who entertain similar beliefs but can't really gain any purchase because of this plurality system, I think that it is the one outstanding reform of our republic, the representative process thereof, that would contribute to better elections and a more muscular democracy.
So you might say the Voting Rights Act has a long way to go yet from theory to total practice.
Well, in that regard, it does. I certainly salute its passage, voted and worked for it, and the amendments thereto. But it doesn't solve the problem of adequately representing women, of adequately representing racial and ethnic groups, adequately representing new parties. One reason third parties don't really get any place is they don't have a voice nationally on the legislative scene. The Republicans won a plurality victory in the 1854 elections and became thereby a second party, succeeding to the mantle of the Whigs. And if they hadn't elected congressmen in 54, they would not have been able to run, not successfully the first time, but a creditable race when John Fremont, their first candidate, ran as a Republican nominee for president. And then 6 years after Fremont, or 4 years after Fremont, they, of course, ran a candidate by the name of Abraham Lincoln, who was elected. So I think it's essential to get some representation on the national scene for independence. You got 44% of the people who voted in the New Hampshire primary in the first primary this year were independents. They don't have any independents sitting in the Congress from New Hampshire. They have one in Vermont, and he's the only one in the nation. One out of 435 independents. So it's incredible to think that we have stalled so long in our recognition of the fact that it is going to take proportional representation to adequately represent the voices of the many different groups in our country that are not now being heard in legislative halls or in the U.S. Congress. And the PR, proportional representation, is the one way you go about achieving that goal.
One last question for you, John, concerning low voter turnout. Now, the Center for Voting and Democracy has done a lot of research on voting, and I'm just wondering...
They put out something called Monopoly Politics 3 or 4 years running now, showing how uncompetitive, non-competitive most of those races are.
Okay. Has there been any one or a handful of overwhelming reasons that you can think of for the low voter turnout?
Well, I've just given you one very important reason. I think campaign finance is another reason. I think people are terribly turned off. Here it is, the paradox of our time. We will have the most expensive election at the national level in history. And very possibly we won't do much better than we did in 1924, more than 75 years ago. We'll have a low, low turnout because almost like Parkinson's law, the level of public dissatisfaction and even contempt with the electoral process rises with the rising flood and tide of money that they darn well know is being poured in by special interests of all kinds in an effort to gain that added edge and added advantage that comes from having the candidate in office know that he is beholden to you. He has mortgaged his seat even before he is seated. And that's what's wrong with our elections. That's why people don't vote.
John, you speak like a fellow philosopher. I want to say it's been an honor talking to you today.
Well, good.